hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. April 15th marked the third anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. And like 9/11, things just don't quite add up. There are many, many unanswered questions and what appears to be a cover-up going on. Here with me today to discuss these two events is attorney John Remington Graham. John Graham is an attorney with decades of experience in the fields of constitutional, environmental, and criminal litigation. He served as a federal public defender special counsel to the city of Brainerd, Minnesota. He received both a Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy and a law degree from the University of Minnesota. He has also worked on legal issues with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and Jokar Tsarnaev's aunt, who is also a lawyer. Today you'll hear the second and final part of my interview with Jack Graham, and that will be followed by a short audio clip of Naomi Wolf addressing a question about the Boston Marathon bombing. So let's begin with attorney Jack Graham.
You can make of this what you want. It's like controlled demolition on 9/11. You can connect the dots in whatever way you want. Only thing we know is that the official conspiracy theory can't be correct. And right. With respect to the Boston bombing, the official count can't be correct. The indictment cannot correctly state the facts. And he could not, as a matter of law, be convicted of this crime. And yet the exculpatory evidence is simply not presented in court.
Now, the Boston Marathon bombing certainly has all the characteristics of a false flag event. Why would the government do this?
Why would the government do this?
Yeah.
The story of false flag events, it has an interesting history in the law. Probably the most famous example or infamous example of a false flag event is the Reichstag fire that occurred shortly after Hitler became Chancellor of Germany in 1933. That false flag event was used to consolidate the power of the Nazi Party and to arrest and execute members of the Communist Party. So it had a political purpose. It was meant to consolidate the power of the party that had the government. In the United States, what would be the objective? Well, take a look at 9/11. It's pretty clear that it was meant to agitate public support for an Anglo-American invasion of Iraq and an American invasion of Afghanistan. It was a false flag event to start a war. And that's very similar to the Reichstag fire. It was meant to agitate public support for wars.
Right. I think with 9/11, that's very obvious. I'm just wondering, with the Boston Marathon bombing, it's
a... I think it was meant to agitate public support for legislation that would facilitate the imposition of martial law. I think that was what the purpose was. I don't know whether they succeeded or not, because there are increasing numbers of Americans who are being very skeptical about this, and if they had hearings in Congress, it might become very controversial, and it would be impossible to conceal the protest from citizens who know what happened. The Boston bombing case is a case of what appears to be an attempted false flag, but it was bungled. It was bungled in the sense that the basic flaw in the government's case is so obvious to anyone whose attention is called to the pertinent facts.
Is there anything that listeners can do to help out, help this innocent?
First thing I would say is, for those who are interested in what actually happened to the buildings on 9/11, go to the website of AE 9/11 Truth. Just write AE 9/11 Truth Home and your Google, and it'll take you there, and read the material that they offer. There is a report on our effort to get a grand jury and the offer of proof and all the evidence that we were prepared to offer. So all you have to do is write AE 9/11 Truth and then Vance, V-A-N-C-E, and you'll get reports that will give you a rich information. And as far as the Boston Marathon, I would suggest you just Google up Paul Craig Roberts, August 17, 2015, and March 29, 2016, and read those reports. In other words, the best thing that Americans can do about this is to be informed. The information is there on the Internet. Stop doubting your own eyes. Become informed and stop being afraid of looking into the facts. In this age of the Internet, vast amounts of information are available. As far as what I know, I would ask that people look at the reports of Paul Craig Roberts last August and this March. And I would also ask that you go to the website of AE911 Truth, Vance, and they'll give you the story of our effort to meet with the state district attorney in New York City with jurisdiction over downtown Manhattan. Those websites will give you all the information you really need.
Right, and they're really great websites. Yeah, they're really great websites. Now, do you see any similar patterns between 9/11 and the Boston Marathon bombing?
Well, sure. They're both based on fabricated false appearances in which the government of the United States is involved. The government of the United States did nothing to expose the essential facts of 9/11. We have Congress, the 9/11 Commission, FEMA, NIST, and the FBI. They all misled the American public. The major news media, like the New York Times and CNN and Fox News and all the rest, were involved in misleading the American public. So this is kind of a double play by the government of the United States and the major news media of the United States, who have misled the people of the country. That happened with both Boston Marathon and 9/11.
Yeah, you have done some research, you were telling me about how the media became so controlled. Maybe you could tell us about that?
Well, yes, I can tell you that I did my work on this question long before I ever had any inkling that there was something wrong with 9/11 and what we were told by the government and the news media, long before the Boston Marathon case ever rose. I am a legal historian, and I grew up in Minnesota, which was the state of Congressman Charles Lindbergh Sr. Congressman Charles Lindbergh Sr. was the father of the famous aviator of whom you have heard. But Congressman Lindbergh was famous for his opposition to the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which sets up the central bank of the United States. So I wanted to check into Congressman Lindbergh's objections and to trace the source of this whole thing. First place, you have to understand that the Federal Reserve may have the legal form of a public instrumentality, but in practical effect, de facto as opposed to de jure, as a practical matter, is a private bank or a set of private banks, and they are controlled by private banks. And Wall Street is the place under this act where they control the banking and currency, the money and credit of the United States. And their instrumentality is the Federal Reserve, which was set up by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, as amended on many occasions since. The question is, where did we get this? The answer is that in the financing of the American Civil War, large banking houses in Europe and in North America purchased the war bonds that enabled the Union government to conquer the South, and they multiplied the national debt of the United States in 1860 by 53 times in only 4 years. So there are a vast amount of these war bonds outstanding, and there was legislation at that time known as the National Bank Act of 1864, which enabled the holders of these war bonds to set up and capitalize a new and dominant and privileged system of powerful banks that basically took over banking currency all over the country. It was ensconced on Wall Street where the central banking institutions, central reserve banks, were located. That cartel, which was established as a result of financing the war between the states, or the War for Southern Independence, or the American Civil War, call it what you will, was legalized and formalized and institutionalized in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. And that was the reason why Congressman Lindbergh put up his heroic fight, and he was certainly the greatest statesman that Minnesota ever produced. And I originally got into this because I was raised in Minnesota and I was attracted to the name of Lindbergh and the father of the aviator, who turned out to be one of the greatest individuals that we've ever produced in public life. And he was the one who led the fight, and he warned. He said, the day that this law is enacted, we will have an invisible government of high finance, which is true. And once the government became this cartel established, they gained control of the major news media of the United States, which they own and control not to make a profit, but in order to shape public opinion and swing elections. And, you know, you only have to swing 10% of the vote. If you can do that, you can control the country.
And it's very clear that they have total control of the media, because without media complicity, they could not have done 9/11 or the Boston Marathon bombing and gotten
Absolutely.
Away with it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And now you have to have news media complicity. The news media was aware, for example, that Zokar was not guilty, because I got the principal exculpatory exhibit, is the third still frame from the Whiskey Steakhouse video. That still frame was on the website of CNN and AP on the 19th of April, 2013. That's where I got my first copy of that exhibit, from the CNN website. It later, I think, was taken down, but in any event, I got it and was able to get the FBI official Whiskey Steakhouse video. It was there. And by the way, that video is packed into the record of Zokar's case, but it was concealed. It was concealed as part of, I think it was government exhibit number 22, but it was packed in there and the jury's attention wasn't called to it.
And the lawyer that was assigned to Zokar by the government didn't bother to point that out?
No. And of course, that's right. Of course, prosecutors are held to a higher standard than defense lawyers. Defense lawyers have a very important and essential role in the administration of justice. I don't mean to diminish that at all. I was a criminal defense lawyer for many years in federal court and in my own county in Minnesota, but I was also a county attorney for a term, and I know that the standard that public prosecutors are held to uphold is higher. They cannot proceed if they don't have probable cause. Their task is not to get a conviction, but to see justice done. And they cannot conceal evidence, or they cannot mislead the jury. A defense lawyer can put in evidence that tends to show that the accused is not guilty, but if he doesn't present all the facts, he's not necessarily doing something that is unethical. But if a prosecutor misleads the jury by leaving out material facts, he has crossed the line and can be disciplined for it.
Is there a date set for the appeal for Zokar Zarnaev?
Well, it's underway now, and I don't know what the scheduling order of the First Circuit is, but it'll be going on for probably another year.
Well, Attorney Jack Graham, is there anything else you'd like to share with us that we haven't discussed so far?
Well, nothing other than the fact that we need to understand that the constitutional government of the United States has been subverted by a banking cartel, and the banking cartel runs both political parties, and they determine who we get to choose from every 4 years when it comes to president. They have a very important role in swinging elections of all kinds throughout the country. They control the press, and they control of our government. And our government and the press have acted together to produce events like 9/11 and the prosecution of Zokar Zarnaev in the Boston Marathon case. That's a pretty shocking thing to understand, but I'm submitting it and I'm asking you to look at the facts. As I said, what can Americans do? They can check out the facts for themselves. They can have the courage to investigate impartially and draw their own conclusions.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of courage, I mean, you have a lot of courage to work with the architects and engineers and also with this trial of the Boston Marathon bombing. Have you had any repercussions from that? Or
I'm living abroad right now, and I'm over the hill in the sense that I've had my active career years. So there isn't much they can do to me now, and I don't have any trouble going into the United States. I know the FBI has a file on me. They've had a profile on me since my early days as a lawyer at the time of the Vietnam War. They had a file on me, and I know that because a member of Congress called me up where I was teaching law at the time and told me that the FBI had a file on me. And they've had a file on me ever since. But they don't give me any trouble because I do a very good job of keeping my nose clean.
Well, thank you so much for all that you've done for justice with 9/11 and with the Boston Marathon bombing. And thank you very much for sharing your information on the show today.
Yeah, well, thank you for including me.
And again, that was attorney Jack Graham, who has worked on legal issues with both Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and Jokhar Tsarnaev's aunt. And now here's that audio clip of Naomi Wolf, recorded in January of 2015, responding to a question about the Boston Marathon bombing.
What do you think of what happened in Boston when we were looking for
bombing?
A pressure cooker and two teenagers, you know, and then they took over the whole city and shut it down? And to me, that looked a whole lot like martial law.
Yeah. Oh, God, I can't believe. See, this is why I didn't want to give this talk, because I knew that we'd have this conversation. And now it's on the record. All right, let me take a step back. We have to deal with it. Let me take a step back and a deep breath, because this is a very painful thing to talk about. So all over the world, we know, it's well established, the State Department and intelligence agencies engage in theater, and it's what they do, it's spycraft, to create spectacles and events that people may not realize are spectacles and events, but that, well, like the overthrow of Mossadegh in the 50s in Iran. They'll funnel money to protesters, they'll, you know, fly people in to infiltrate protesters, they'll create fake newspapers, and so on. So we know that this happens in countries around the world. I believe that a law has been passed in the United States, I think it's part of the Defense Authorization Act, I need to confirm this, that now makes it legal to propagandize American citizens. Is that, do we know about that? Yeah, it's true. And is it in the NDAA or is it in something else, do we know?
It's a separate bill.
It's a separate bill, and it's been passed, it's now law? 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So what this means is, and I, you know, as a journalist to say these words, just I can't tell you with what a heavy heart I say them, but we've entered an era in which it is not crazy to assess news events to see if they're real or not real, and in the United States as well as overseas. And in fact, it's kind of crazy not to. Now, you know, there's so much hype about what I just said, and so I want to be very clear about it so it can't be taken out of context. You know, there's this kind of reflexive vilification of anyone speculating about that because they become a conspiracy theorist, right? Well, just bear with me. You know, I've often thought about this because our intelligence agencies, and I respect spies. I mean, you know, who are doing, like, before it got out of control, I believe we need intelligence. I believe we need intelligence agencies. I don't think there's anything dishonorable about being in the intelligence services if you obey the Constitution and the law. But all over the world, our intelligence services are engaged in conspiring to create outcomes. That's their job. That's how they're successful. So now that it's illegal to propagandize in the United States, it doesn't surprise me that there's more and more products coming up in popular culture, more and more events in the news stream that seem to be, to my eye, to be subsidized. Let me give you some examples of that. I'm not talking about Boston right now. I'll get to that. We also talked earlier about infiltrators, right? And how they provoke violence. This is well established. So if we know that infiltrators by the police, NYPD, they've been documented, or other police forces, dress up like people they're not and provoke violence, why is it unthinkable that there might be spectacles that might drive an outcome in the news stream? Let me give you a couple of quick examples. And all I'm saying is we, unfortunately, and I have to say this to my fellow journalists as well, we've entered a time in which we need to be very skeptical about the news stream and look at it critically and ask for more verification and more inquiry. And that's just being good reporters. And it makes it like this. There's spectacle fed into the news media in China. There's spectacle fed into, like, Chile. How did Pinochet, you know, engage in his coup? He created photographs of a cache of weapons that the terrorists had, you know, hidden. Was it real? Was it not? Most historians think it wasn't. I mean, this is, like, not unusual, you know, in the process of creating a closed society. So if laws have made it legal to assassinate American citizens and legal to propagandize them, why should it be crazy or weird to think that that might be for a reason, right? All right. I saw the movie Zero Dark Thirty, and I have worked on two presidential campaigns, so I recognize political talking points. And I wrote a piece saying, this reads like the Pentagon signed off on the script. Because there were like chunks of political talking points identifiable to anyone who's worked in Washington, right? And you don't come up with those if you're a writer writing a screenplay. And everyone was very upset. It was very controversial and scandalous. But in fact, belatedly, a news story came out saying that in fact the Pentagon had, I think, subsidized some of it, but had certainly consulted directly on the script. And I see more and more TV shows about the CIA and more TV shows about spies and gigantic blockbusters in which surveillance is normalized and gigantic blockbusters in which people are tortured to get them to talk in a way that might exonerate people who actually tortured people to get them to talk in Guantanamo. And there's all this money being pumped into these unaccountable, you know, terrorism fighting things. And now there's no law preventing that money from going through front organizations right into popular culture. So that's of interest to me. And another thing I want to say, I'm skeptical of certain news events that seem more theatrical than the norm, or I want to ask questions about them. Because I was in CNN once recently, and they were reporting a story about a water skier who had been decapitated on a lake between Mexico and the United States, and it had something to do with a terrorism threat. Right? And I was like, decapitated water skier. Sometimes you hear these things and it's like so novelistic. You're like, real life doesn't work that way. Like, these are so novelistic. Someone's coming up with it to make it stick in the popular imagination. Or it just makes you think, well, I'd like to document that. I'm a reporter. What's the source? And it kept being just this one guy, Judge Arpajo in Texas. I may be mispronouncing his name. He's a very, he was the source, he was the source, he was the source. And I have this wonderful Facebook community all over the world. And I went on Facebook and I'm like, Mexican Facebook community, is there any reporting about a beheaded water skier in this lake, in this place in Mexico? And they're like, no, what are you talking about? There's nothing like that. Doesn't exist. So I turned to the CNN producer and said, do you have a second source for this story? And it was all over the news, all over the news, all over the news. And they're like, and they checked and it's like, nope, just this guy, judge, whatever. And I'm like, well, can you find a second source? And they were blushing and embarrassed, and they looked and they confessed that they didn't have a second source, which if you know what journalism is, you're supposed to confirm it with two sources. So ever since that experience, CNN is running with this. No one's verifying it. Journalists aren't in a position to follow up on anything anymore because budgets are slashed and there's no investigative reporting. All this nonsense can enter the media stream for purposes that have to do with advancing agendas, because no one's checking. That's all I want to say about that. So Boston, I guess my feeling about any of these things is, let's investigate. We need to investigate. We need to ask better questions. We need to interview the doctors at the hospital. We need to interview the victims. We need to, you know, get all the footage ourselves. We need to train citizens to be journalists and to have websites. And I'm busy building one as a startup where citizen journalists can document events so that we're not leaving it to the gatekeepers.
As you can see, Naomi Wolf was nervous in talking about these taboo subjects, such as false flag staged events like the Boston Marathon bombing. And to her credit, she was willing to speak to it at least somewhat, and to use the term conspiracy theorists, and say that to not question what we're being told by government and media is really the crazy position. You know, I just went to see the new film called Occupying America's Mind at Trinity College last week. It's a really good informative movie. And after, my friend and I went to speak to the producer of the film, a leading guy on the left, a professor,
And when asked about 9/11, he said, "Oh, I don't go into conspiracies." And that's crazy. And think of all the time wasted on these conspiracy theories. It's just a distraction. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard that from leaders on the left and the anti-war movement. Somebody's gotten to them because they all use the same lines. It's a conspiracy. It's a distraction. It's a waste of time. So for Naomi Wolf to address this in as limited a way as she did takes some courage. I remember Mark Crispin Miller saying that once he started talking about 9/11, all of his many mainstream media connections and interviews suddenly dried up. So it's up to us to keep pushing, to keep spreading the word through leaflets, videos, articles, radio shows, books, and cable access TV shows. So please do whatever you can to spread the word so that someday people like Naomi Wolf will feel totally comfortable talking about 9/11, the Boston Marathon bombing, etc. Jokhar Tsarnaev is now in a prison in Colorado being held incommunicado under special administrative measures. In a recent article posted on the website Who What Why, author Russ Baker explores some of the unanswered questions about the Boston Marathon bombing. And here's the first one. What was Tsarnaev's relationship with the FBI-CIA? What was the true nature of the FBI or CIA's relationship with the Tsarnaev family, particularly Tamerlane? Since the beginning, we've been seeing more and more evidence, circumstantial and otherwise, that there is way more to this backstory than the government will admit. The FBI, after claiming it didn't know Tamerlane Tsarnaev, was forced to admit that it had known him before the bombing. In fact, its agents had been in and out of his house several times over a number of years and had investigated him. There seems no doubt that the FBI was very interested in Tamerlane and his circle of friends, who were exactly the sort of young Muslims typically recruited as informants. Why was Tsarnaev, a potential terrorist, given such freedom of movement? Number three, why apply SAMs? Why is Jokhar Tsarnaev being held incommunicado under special administrative measures, even though the government maintains he and his brother acted alone and were not part of a terrorist network? What are the powers that be afraid, he'll say, to the outside world? Why harass Tsarnaev's associates? Why did the government go, quote, scorched earth on all of Tsarnaev's friends, family, and associates, harassing, deporting, and in one case shooting to death individuals who the government readily admits had no connection to the bombing? Were they being preemptively silenced? Like the Tsarnaev case, the shooting death was full of anomalies, stunning discrepancies, and suppression of inquiry. Next question, what happened on April 17th at the courthouse? Why has there been no credible explanation of the events around the federal courthouse on the afternoon of Wednesday, April 17th? We are told that unfounded speculation about an arrest and a suspect in custody is what caused reporters to converge on the courthouse. Yet at least two journalists inside the building were told by court officials, including judges, that a person was expected in court and that courtroom number 18 and an overflow room were being prepared. Reports of a suspect in custody were then denied by law enforcement, and half an hour later, the courthouse was evacuated because of a bomb threat. During the, quote, code red, we see a U.S. Marshal's wagon with an armed footplate rider enter the courthouse building. Oddly, the existence of a motorcade to the courthouse was acknowledged, but nobody has said what the motorcade was or why it was headed to the court. Next question, why was surveillance footage of the policeman shooting edited? And why did the carjacking victim give such conflicting stories? We have been told that the Tsarnaev brothers carjacked a foreign national student, but that story is full of holes too. Why did carjacking victim, quote, Danny Meng, give such wildly conflicting accounts of the carjacking and his subsequent, quote, escape? And the last question, why was the gas station surveillance footage edited? Why does the gas station surveillance camera footage shown in court appear to contradict Meng's testimony about what happened in the SUV? He was never seriously cross-examined. Why was that footage so tightly edited? And why did they remove the video's timestamp? How come nobody in law enforcement can seem to get the color of the backpack correct? And now I just want to remind you that this evening, Wednesday, April 27th, 2016, we'll be showing the movie Weight of Chains 2, and it will be at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. For more information, please check our website, wwuh.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people.